You are listening to the Sports Daily. I'm your host, Reality Steve. Thank you all for tuning in. A great, and I mean great, Wednesday show for you, because I am joined by the one and only Bob Sturm from the Hardline, 3 to 7 p.m., Monday through Friday, here in Dallas, 96.7 The Ticket. He is an encyclopedia when it comes to the NFL draft. The NFL draft is starting tomorrow. Bob is anchoring the Ticket's coverage. He's going to Detroit today. He will be there in Detroit at the draft Thursday, Friday, Saturday. That's why I wanted to have him on before the draft. We recorded this on Monday, so keep that in mind. And we talk about the draft. We talk about the Masters. We talk about a little hockey as well, because Bob is a big hockey guy. We'll get to all that momentarily. This podcast brought to you by Bet Online. Bet Online is your number one source for all your summer sports this season. Major League Baseball, golf, NBA, and NHL playoff stats. All the latest stats, news, and scores available to follow your favorite teams. Get the latest odds and lines, including the latest team matchups, player props, and odds on just about every sport out there. Head to the website today or use your mobile device to get in on the action. Bet Online, where the game starts. All right, so before we get to Bob, I just wanted to run over a couple things here. I'm recording this open before any of the games have ended on Tuesday night. So we will discuss what happened to the Dallas Mavericks and Clippers game tomorrow. But I wanted to bring Bob on, like I said in the open. He is anchoring the Ticket's coverage. You can actually listen to it even if you're out of state. Download the Sports Day app wherever you get your apps on your phone. Sports Day app, just listen because Bob is, and I'm telling you this, Bob says it at the beginning, but I'm going to repeat it because I think it's very important. 95% of the people that you listen to on the radio that talk about the NFL draft don't do what Bob does. They just read what other people wrote and then just regurgitate it. Bob actually studies film. He writes reviews of these players. Like, he knows what he's talking about. He has spent, and I'm not talking about, oh, he popped on a tape. He's watched hours and hours of tape of guys that are going to be taken in the third and fourth round. Like, this is his job. And he even talks about it in the beginning of the interview where it's just like, for the longest time, he goes, I felt like a fraud. I'm talking about these guys that I watched on Saturdays, but did I really study them? No. And I decided I'm going to do this. I want to, you know, learn more and learn more about these players. And it's not just for the draft. He's been doing it since 05. So almost 20 years now he's been doing this. But he is just an encyclopedia when it comes to the NFL draft. We basically, you know, we're not going to sit here, and I don't spend a lot of time with Bob talking about offensive linemen. Bob is very long-winded, as you know, and I love that about him. I have no problem him giving a five-minute answer. I don't care, because I learn something every time I talk to him. And, you know, most of the talk about the players going in tomorrow's draft, we focus on the quarterbacks. We focus on the quarterbacks and the wide receivers and, you know, the players that you probably remember. Yes, he goes into a little offensive lineman talk and defensive lineman talk, but it's over about a more grand scheme of things when it comes to the NFL draft. He's not just giving you a scouting report on every offensive lineman that's out there or whatever. It's more about draft position, what teams are looking for, how you build a roster, stuff like that. So this is just a great interview. We also talk about the Masters, and because Bob went to the Masters this year, wasn't there for the tournament, but was there Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and he relays what it was like being at the Masters, and the way he tells it is awesome. And then we actually get to talking about hockey, because Bob is a huge, huge hockey guy. I've become more of a hockey guy in the last 5 years or so when my nephew started playing. And I'm a very much a novice when it comes to hockey. I know the rules and whatever. I know the big names in the game, but I pretty much only watch Dallas Stars hockey. I'm not going to watch a regular season hockey game. But if you were listening to the Sports Daily last year, you know how excited I get when it comes to playoff hockey, because I think it's awesome. It's a totally different animal. The only thing I like better than probably playoff hockey is March Madness, the first weekend of March Madness. It's just those two things for me are the best. So we recorded this Monday before the Stars game against the Vegas Golden Knights. And, you know, what Bob said basically came to fruition. This is a team that, for whatever reason, has struggled out of the gate in games and in series. And what happened? 90 seconds into game one, they were already down 1-0. And then when Bob wrote his, he has his bobsturm.substack.com, which everybody should, I think, subscribe to. It's $85 a year. You can sign up monthly. Totally worth it. But he did a review in yesterday's column, three things about the Stars game. And one of the biggest notes in there that I wrote down was, and I didn't even realize this, the Dallas Stars haven't won game one in front of a crowd since 2019 in any playoff series. They have lost every game one of every playoff series they have been in front of a crowd since 2019. I say in front of a crowd because in 2020, in the bubble, there was no crowd, and I think that just changes things. They did win a game one during that run, and I don't know if you remember this, but the Stars made the Stanley Cup Finals during the bubble. So I don't remember how many of those four series they won game one, but he basically eliminated that season just because playing in front of a crowd, I think, plays a huge role. So, yeah, this is what they do. They lose game one. Last year, they got to the Western Conference Finals, but yet in the first round against Minnesota, lost game one at home. Second round against Seattle, lost game one at home. Like, I don't know what it is with this team, but I would say tonight is a must win. Anyway, we talk a little hockey at the end with Bob, and he gives his breakdown and explains just how fickle hockey can be. And it's just, he's dead on with his hockey take. Anyway, I just wanted to get that out there. It's such a great conversation. It's about an hour long, and Bob he's an encyclopedia. I'd say the first half hour to 35 minutes is NFL draft talk. So check that out. Can't wait for you to hear it. Here it is, Bob Sturm from The Ticket in Dallas. All right, let's bring him in. He's the co-host of the Hardline 3-7 every day on The Ticket in Dallas. He is an encyclopedia when it comes to the NFL draft. If you have not subscribed to his Substack, do so immediately at bobsturm.substack.com. Draft is Thursday, so I had to bring him on. It is Bob Sturm. Bob, thanks for coming on, man.
Anytime. Great to be back.
You know, when you're giving me breakdowns of Yale offensive linemen, that's when I know you absolutely love covering this sport. It is great. Your Sturm 60 breaking down for the last 2 months, first, second, even third round picks, it's been awesome. And you don't do this for anything other than, obviously you do it for your Substack readers, yeah. But this is just, you love doing this, don't you?
No, I do. I do. And it, you know, it's kind of probably more interesting of a backstory than it is actually diving too deep into these guys, because I've been doing this for a long time. And to be honest with you, I felt like around 2005 or so, I was kind of living a lie, but I was living a lie with everybody else. And so it seemed like you weren't lying. You were just doing what the media does. So we would get to the draft. It's a huge thing. The station tells us what a big deal it is, and fans are giddy about how to save the Cowboys with one draft. And I'm just thinking to myself, man, I've seen these dudes play low in college football, most of them, but I feel like I am simply reading out of a magazine and I'm taking someone else's word for it. And that just feels like, it just feels wrong. It feels like the media needs to be honest about their work. And so this whole generation of draft nerds, of which I consider myself like an older uncle, because I think most of them are like 30, which is fine.
Yeah.
But I think technology and maybe the stupidity of buying a Street and Smith's and thinking that whoever wrote it had watched these guys, it came to a head. And so I'm not saying we're any smarter than we were, but at least we're all trying to do our own homework, and I wanted to do that. And so now I really got lost in this winding road, Steve, because now I'm not even doing the best 60 players. Now I'm doing 60 players that I think cover the Cowboys' first three picks. And so their third pick is number 87. And if you look at the net of names you would need to profile, it would probably be over 100 to get all of the possibilities at number 87. And therefore, since I can only fit about 12 weeks of draft work into my life at about one guy a day, I decided, okay, I'm going to not spend hours and hours and hours on Caleb Williams. I know Caleb Williams. I don't need to do that. I don't need to do Jaden Daniels. I don't need to do Marvin Harrison, because we all know those guys. So now I'm trying to hit their first three picks with guys I've studied, and that takes you to like Yale and and other places. So it's a process that keeps evolving, and I keep making myself more insane, but I do enjoy doing it. So that's a long answer for a short question.
So here's the thing that I wanted to get to, which was the quarterbacks, because that's the thing on everybody's mind is Caleb Drake May and Jaden Daniels. I'm assuming you've studied all three of these guys.
For sure.
Is your ranking Caleb Drake Jaden, or is it Caleb Jaden Drake?
It's Caleb Jaden Drake. And I feel it's not a slight on Drake May. It isn't. It's just one that's, you know, more of a, I think Jaden Daniels has enough Lamar Jackson in him, but probably superior traits when it comes to playing quarterback, if that is fair. And so I think he has a higher upside. Now, May is one of those guys that will make you look at him and say, okay, I can definitely see how this can become a superstar quarterback. But I will admit, I'm also a little bit taken aback with some of the valleys. And I just think his consistency is lower. So you know, all of them, or seemingly many of these quarterbacks in the top tier, have sort of reinvented themselves as they went. And so you know, it's where the portal plays such a role in these quarterbacks, with like Daniels and Nicks and the dudes at Penix who have gone from school to school. And I don't pretend that I was locked into Jaden Daniels at Arizona State. I won't even try to fool you on that, because I'm not watching a true freshman at Arizona State in the fall. I just can't. But by the time he got to LSU, I was pretty blown away, and I just think he has a shorter path to superstardom. He also has a shorter path to the hospital because of the way he takes hits. And so, you know, all these guys, and what's funny about it is if you go back just like 5 years and look at all the guys we've put into the top five and seen how few of them have delivered on their promise. And the, you know, many of them are already in the, you either pay him $50 million a season or you let him walk. I just think the quarterback position has never been more interesting, and the risk is higher, but at the same time, teams are quicker to get rid of them if they don't think they're the guy and just send them back off into space. Like the Bears giving up on Justin Fields. And I'm not saying it's the wrong decision. I'm just saying that would have never happened 5 years ago, I don't think. I think we've sped up the process, and you have a shorter amount of time to wait, which adds in guys like Jordan Love, who they waited, and they seem to be really happy. But maybe a year from now, we're saying the Packers need one of these top guys. So there's no absolutes in the quarterback game for sure.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Looking at the odds of this, it just doesn't seem that all three are going to be, I don't know, superstars. Chances are two of these three aren't going to make it, and it might only be one. If you had to choose which one has the biggest bustability factor in those three, who would it be? Would it be Drake?
That's interesting. Yes, I think so. I do want to say that his ceiling is very high.
Yeah.
And you know, honestly, what people don't talk about with Drake May enough for me is what he does with his feet. Like he is a really strong athlete when he wants to, you know, be kind of my favorite type of quarterback is the guy who is not thinking about winning with his feet until it's third and nine. And I think that's like prime Aaron Rodgers was so great at just killing you by running for just enough and then resetting the downs and keeping a drive alive. I just think that's such a beautiful, you know, and Mahomes obviously has it, but it's such a beautiful trait of a guy who knows he can probably run for a first down, not whenever he wants, but pretty close. and yet has the smarts to say, I want to win from the pocket until it's my last resort. And so, you know, that obviously keeps you healthy. That keeps you on the field. There's no answer for a quarterback who misses a month every season. You just can't deal with that long term, and you definitely can't pay that long term. And so, you know, the ability to play 16, 17 games, but also have a threat with your feet, I think, is a really valuable trait. So all three of these quarterbacks have that. Caleb absolutely throws enough passes that are just stupid great that you are willing to overlook some of the blinking lights. And you know, like with Jaden again, I forgot, I think Nate Tice said it, and I can't get it out of my head, you can put a clip tape together of Jaden Daniels that looks like Johnny Knoxville, where he's just getting absolutely, you know, hit by a charging bull, and Johnny Knoxville would go flying. And that's what happens when Jaden takes some of these hits in the open field. And so they all have bustability. And I'm really reluctant after, like, Sam Darnold screwed me up so much. There are just guys that look like they're going to be stars in the NFL for a decade. And Sam Darnold never even got out of the starter's block. And so you look back at that and you're like, what am I missing here? And honestly, you know, sometimes it does just go back to, did these guys find a home that wasn't filled with morons? And that's what we don't know. Like, if the Chiefs and the Bears flipped that famous draft day situation where, you know, we think the Chiefs might have taken Trubisky if Mahomes was gone, and we know that the Bears had Mahomes if they didn't get Trubisky, which is hilarious.
Yeah.
But if Mahomes goes to Chicago, do they have three parades already? I don't know, man. There's a lot of morons in that organization. And conversely, is Trubisky sort of out of the league if he's with Andy Reid? You know, so it just ties your brain in knots. And you know, it's fun to study this, but there's so much information that we don't have, including what's going to happen to them when they leave the nurturing bosom of their college and go to an NFL city and have to hear and read about how much they suck for months at a time. Do they have the mental toughness? And I'm looking at you, Caleb, to be able to handle that and to not let it change you. And there's just so many variables about what happens after draft day that it makes projections on draft day kind of silly, but I still love it.
I probably watched, I don't know, probably five or six games of North Carolina the last 2 years. And
yeah,
this is just me not breaking down any tape with a blind eye. Something with Drake just was like, he didn't wow me. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean you have to wow somebody, because when I saw Caleb Williams and Jaden Daniels, they have the wow factor when they play. Drake May just was there, did well. His defense sucked both years, so it's like I can't blame him for winning, you know, losing 45, 42 games. But there was just always something about him that I was like, I thought this guy was the next thing, and he just never jumped out at me. But like I said, it could just be a guy that just needs to get in the right system and stuff like that. But is that what you saw when you saw tape of Drake?
Yeah, but, you know, we do this every year with different guys. That's the thing. It, you know, like when I watched Justin Herbert at Oregon, I sat there and I'm like, I'm not sure I fully get it. Now, here's the crazy thing about the Justin Herbert discussion. Were we wrong? Yeah. You know, as we evaluate being so wrong about Justin Herbert and the fact that he's going to run the NFL for, you know, a decade or whatever people say, well, on one hand, I'm still sort of waiting for it. You know, there are performances. If you go back to the Monday night game when Dallas was in Los Angeles and Dallas was on the ropes for their season and they just looked awful going into that game, and yet they won that game partly because Justin Herbert missed, I want to say, three touchdowns, and he missed them all badly. And, you know, they lost the game by one score. And so that matters, and we're a ways into the Justin Herbert career where you're just like, you know, here's the problem with scouting is if the guy doing the scouting is only going to look at his highlight tape, you're going to be miffed at all the highlights he leaves on the table. And so with Drake May, I see what you're saying for sure. He threw a few passes in that Clemson game, for instance, that I think are 10 out of 10. And at the same time, he misses passes that are layups and free throws in the NFL. And so if you can hit the half court shot, but you're missing too many layups, we're going to have to ask questions about, can you consistently put us in a position to win? And so, you know, he's got that. Justin Herbert had it. Josh Allen had it. And you start going through the list of, okay, how much of that can we overcome? And how much of it can we overcome without including him in the equation? Like, is our defense good enough to get the ball back? Can we get turnovers? Does our running back do some things? You know, is our offensive line able to keep him out of chaos? Like that's when you look at Caleb this year, I can tell you his best throws are, again, like Aaron Rodgers, MVP, four MVP prime. And yet somehow they lost a ton of games, and you reconcile it by saying Lincoln Riley did not have proper talent around Caleb, and he felt going into some of these games he's going to have to score 50 to win. Yeah. Or 45 to win. And that's a different style of quarterback, because when I'm looking at a quarterback, one of the first categories I really try to break down is, does this guy understand ball security? I want the highlights, don't get me wrong, but I know that turnovers absolutely sink our ship. In the biggest games, if you are giving the ball away and giving a short field and giving a possession away, you're going to get us beat. And so I can't live with that. I know in the 70s they could. You could have as many interceptions as touchdowns, but this is the 70s. We play a much more efficient style of football. So in a perfect world, you want prime Tom Brady or prime Aaron Rodgers, which would have 48 touchdowns and 6 interceptions. And of course, that's insane. Those are all-time seasons. But I got to be careful that you are not trying to play basketball at quarterback, which means, boy, I got a lot of sports metaphors, don't I? Yeah. But it simply means you understand that sometimes a punt is okay. And if Caleb is in there saying, man, if we punt once a half, I'm going to lose because our defense sucks. Well, now your mentality is changing to where every decision you make is going to be pedal to the metal and let's try to score here. And that's just not reasonable, because now your mind starts justifying throwing it between the safeties or throwing it into traffic or trying to fit a ball into a dinner plate space. And you know, you have to have aversion to turnovers. And I think Caleb got way too far in the wrong direction this year. Now, it's understandable. And the question will be, when he gets to the NFL, can he dial that back, and can a coach harness him? You know, the famous Brett Favre-Mike Holmgren relationship was Favre wanting to push the ball all the time and Holmgren trying to choke it out of him. And, you know, at a certain point, I got to know that you're not going to YOLO throws into the deep secondary on a regular basis because you think you have to win every game on every down, because that's no way to live as a quarterback in the NFL. The defenses are too good.
You know, hyperbole runs wild in your business, in the sports talk world, the hot take world that we live in. Merrill Hodge is out there, and he has said some things about some of these guys this season that I'm like, is this just clickbait on Merrill? But he really was the first guy to ever put his name behind the fact that he thought Johnny Manziel was going to be terrible, and any team that wasted a first-round pick on him was going to pay for it.
Right.
He has said this year that Caleb is going to be a bust and Drake May will get a coach fired. I don't know if we're looking at that extreme with those two, but, you know, I hear stuff like that. I'm just like, man, you just, you know, we know it's kind of a crapshoot. But the one guy that intrigues me the most in this draft is Michael Penix Jr. And I think I saw Albert Breer, who, good NFL analyst, I think. I like his stuff. He says that coaches seem to like him better than the scouts do, which I thought was really interesting. Makes me think he's probably going to go higher than he's being projected. When you have looked at Michael Penix, Obviously, the age and the injury history is red flag for everybody right now, although he ran, I think, a 4.4 at his combine. What do you see with Michael Penix, and where do you think he ultimately ends up? Do you think he goes in the first round, or do you think he drops to second?
Yeah, I think he absolutely goes in the first round. I just think we spend a lot of time trying to figure out the quarterback position, and then we try to knock him down a little bit for things like age and injury history. And I get all that; it makes sense. I mean, these are massive investments. But I when I see somebody on the clock at, I don't know, 14 or 15 or 18, and they have a chance to have a quarterback who might be the best pure passer in the entire draft. And all the experience you can imagine, like the Raiders aren't going to pass on that, right? You know, you start looking at some of these teams that are, you know, in the first round and they have no answer at quarterback whatsoever. You get the impression that part of it is going to be trying to talk yourself into something where you maybe are seeing something that isn't fully there. But when I see like the Raiders at 13 and you know, you start going back from there, and there's the Steelers at 20 and some of these teams, and you're just like, okay, so talk me through this. You have a guy who, even, you know, and obviously the Michigan tape sucks, but the Texas tape is perfect. I mean, yeah. Perfect. He had, I want to say, 6 big time throws and 0 turnover worthy plays against a team that thought they were about to win the national title. So that's not, you know, beating up against Dartmouth or Cornell or something like this. This is big time NFL defenders trying to get to you. And Penix is just as cool as they come. And so, you know, again, if you go back to that Indiana tape, it might scare you, especially the fact that like 3 different seasons have ended for injury.
Yeah.
But man, if a team is willing to blindly just give a 4th for Trey Lance after another team doesn't even think he's their backup, I have a hard time believing that somebody in the, you know, out of the top 10, but in the first round isn't. And maybe this is a trade-up candidate, but I just think Penix is ready to play. Yes, you're going to wonder about his knees. Yes, you're going to wonder why a guy that fast doesn't run more. You know, there's plenty of questions, but man, all you got to do is look at the big-time throws and say, don't I believe that we are a quarterback who can win in the pocket away from being a playoff team? I've got to take a chance here on Michael Penix, or I'm going to get fired if we have one more bad season. And so, you know, I think that's what fuels decisions, is trying to win and trying to win now. And that's why I am positive Michael Penix is going on day one. Mark this so when I'm wrong, it's extra funny. But there's just no question to me he's going as one of the top 5 quarterbacks in this draft, I would say.
So when you're looking at everything, first round, second round, are you going to be on the coverage on the ticket Thursday and Friday, or just Thursday? Or are you
Thursday, Friday, and Saturday?
Oh, you're doing all 7 rounds. Okay.
This is the first time that I'm really, you know, I love Norm and I miss him, but this will be the first time where Norm's retirement really kicks me in the butt, because. I've been able to cherry pick for like 20 years, and my day has come where they're saying, you know, you're anchoring this, you're there for every pick. We're building the draft around your brain. So get ready for the longest weekend of your life in Detroit. So I'm gearing up, and we're going, and I'm going to give you everything I got. And, then I'll still have Saturday to fight through, and we'll get there. Saturday night we'll get here at some point, and I'll be ready for it when it does.
So just looking at early rounds, let's say rounds 1 and 2,
yes,
a guy that you think pretty much everyone has going in the first round that you don't think is a first round talent, and vice versa. I don't want to call anybody a sleeper because everybody's got the same information pretty much, but somebody that's being projected second, maybe late, you know, early third, that you think is a first round talent. So both of those, who are you seeing that you've dissected?
That's interesting, you know, because this is probably where The fact that I didn't spend a day with each of these wide receivers is going to bite me a little bit. But I do think that that this is a draft where the top 50 or 60 picks, I think we're going to be amazed at how many wide receivers and offensive line go, especially offensive line. Man, I did 22 offensive linemen this year, which is absurd. Now, a lot of that is because the Cowboys have gutted their own offensive line, and we are trying to sort out how they're going to survive that. But, you know, it's what it does, though, is it sort of flattens the urgency. And that's why I think you could find a spot here where some of these wide receivers end up going a little later in offensive linemen. For instance, like center, like everyone, including me, has said, if the Cowboys walk away from pick 24 with Jackson Powers Johnson from Oregon, what I think is the best center in the draft, and I'm not positive there's a good argument against it, unless you want to tell me that Graham Barton is absolutely a center. I think he can probably do anything you want from Duke. But the point is, I wonder about the urgency to take a center that high. And so, as much as I like Jackson Powers Johnson, to me, the fifth and sixth best centers in this draft could probably be had in the third round. So I could see a war room saying, are we really going to take a center at pick 24 if we could get 80% of him at pick 87, you know? Yeah. And so that's what happens, is it isn't necessarily an evaluation of a certain player as much as it is an evaluation of the depth at a certain position group. And also knowing that most of the league would never take a center in round one. That's a very rare thing to do. And it's like, actually the best one for your average fan would be the running back market, right? So we don't necessarily value running backs like we once did. We don't put them in the first round and we don't give them giant contract extensions. But on game day, running back is very important. So in this particular draft, there's no Bijan Robinson. But there are, I think Dane Brugler said this best, and then I went through each of them and I said, doggone, Dane's good at what he does. There are roughly 10 running backs that you would say top two rounds feels a little rich, but round three sounds about right. And so that's how big runs will start, is like, everybody will hold their water on running back until one team gives in, which, by the way, might be the Cowboys at 56. And when they do, now everybody will say, oh, we better get our running back. And we'll see running backs go, you know, 8 of the next 12 picks. Yeah,
the dam's going to break at that point.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And so I think, you know, if you, just to answer your question, if I said, you know, if we look back in 5 years, who should be in the first round and who maybe shouldn't have been, I think it's very possible Florida State's Trey Benson will be seen as a first round talent. Like if we say top 32 players in the 2024 draft, I think Florida State's Trey Benson probably belongs there. But I also think, based on our current cyclical position on running backs, there's a good chance he doesn't go till round three. And that's just the nature of that beast. And then conversely, I think Jackson Powers Johnson is somebody everyone has in the first round. But I think, you know, when it gets to it and you see Graham Barton and you see Zach Frazier from West Virginia, and then you drop down a little further and it's Cooper Beebe from Kansas State and Tanner Bordellini and Cedric Van Pran. So all these centers, and I know nothing gets the people going like talking center depth in a draft, but you know, I think that's a spot where those first round centers might get moved back a little bit. The exception will be Barton, because Duke's Graham Barton is a left tackle at Duke, but they keep moving him inside because of arm length and things of that nature. But he went through the draft process and kept moving up ticks. You know what I'm saying? In terms of, and I don't know what I think about this. This is the funny thing, is I am a tape guy. I don't think pro day or workouts or 40 time or three cone should improve a tape or also disqualify. Like if a guy is a college football monster and he only runs a 4.55 as a wide receiver, I'm still going to say, yeah, but he did that in college and they couldn't cover him. And I think that, I, you know, like Dez Bryant was a 4.55 guy. I think it will equate pretty well. You don't have to run, be a 4.29 to be a NFL superstar. So Graham Barton checked all the boxes. He interviewed well. He went to the combine. He had a pro day with his shirt off. He looks like Tyron Smith, maybe a white version of Tyron Smith, to be fair. But, you know, with the shirt off, he's doing great work. And he just looks – he doesn't look like a center. He looks like a guy who takes good care of his body. And I think he probably is first round no matter what. But then you start looking at some of these other dudes. Texas's Tavondre Sweat was a guy that when I did his tape, I'm like – I think this is a first rounder. Nobody else does, but I think he is. And then he got a DUI and he showed up at the combine fat and everybody started saying that, you know, he's never anywhere. He needs to be on time. And then you're like, okay, well, this guy may not even go in the second round. And so I've got guys like that. And again, I am the master at not just giving you a direct answer, but those are, that's my stream of consciousness on guys that I think will be either higher or lower. And when you evaluate these guys, I don't think the evaluation process should be, where are they actually going to be taken? It should be, what kind of player do I think this guy will be in the NFL? And do I think he'll be a first round value in 3 years when we look back at this draft, which I suppose is a great way for me to hedge things.
Well, final thing on NFL draft before I want to end with two other non-draft topics.
Sure.
It seemed like all season long it was just a done deal that Marvin Harrison Jr., best wide receiver in the draft. And then all of a sudden, I don't know if people were just trying to zag and, you know, play contrarian with Malik Nabers. But when you look at both of them, do you think – is it more about where each one goes, or is there one that you think is clearly better than the other?
Wow, that's a good one, because I think they're both going to be absolute studs. And so to get too far into the weeds of, is there a real edge? I think the questions about Harrison would be, why didn't he do the testing? And I think this is another really interesting deal where maybe in 10 years we're going to look back at the combine and say, remember when the combine was a big thing? Because I kind of think the combine on some level is going away. And the reason I say that is I believe we're going to convert some point, and it might not be all at the same time, but we're going to convert to a spot where teams are going to say, we believe in the player tracking data. And we're taking his times from his three fastest plays against Michigan this year, and or three different games from his college football season. I really think with player tracking, we're going to replace the 40 time and the underwear Olympics, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, you got guys like Marvin Harrison saying, "No, I'm not going to run a 40. You got my tape. You watched me dominate at the college football level. Why do I have to now show up in March and run with all these other guys and have you basically hurt my stock because my 40 time is not where you think it should be? Like you literally saw me play at this level. What's in it for me to run?" And we saw that with quarterbacks. Now we're seeing it with guys like Marvin Harrison. Malik Nabers says, "Sure, I'll run." And he runs a 4.38. And people are saying, is this guy better than Justin Jefferson was? I think Roma Dunze is a stud. And so I think those top three guys are all going to be wonderful wide receivers. So maybe the real value is letting somebody else spend a top five pick on Harrison, and then you spend a top 12 pick on a Dunze, and you actually feel like you got a better, you know, you got a better value at least. But for me, it's hard for me to walk away from Malik Nabers, because I feel like this is a yak league right now, and what he does after the catch is stupid. Like I was at Death Valley for the A&M game, and he caught a simple crosser and he hit the nitro, and he was down the sideline or around the corner and down the sideline before you could even process what was happening. And those are some NFL caliber defenders. And and that type of lightning to take a 8-yard pass and to turn it into a 68-yard pass is what football's all about, right? Low degree of difficulty throws, and then you go do the rest of the work because you're just faster than other guys. But you still have good size, and yeah. you still are a good receiver. Harrison, I don't think, has the same yak, but of course he has unbelievable efficiency at the catch point, and of course great route running, bloodlines, everything you're looking for there. Marvin Harrison, I've heard it compared that Harrison is Larry Fitzgerald. And I think, when we look back at Larry Fitzgerald's career, we would say that guy was a legend. Was he ever thought of as the best receiver in football? He was in the conversation, but I don't think he ever got like the pub of Megatron or guys of that particular era, even T.O. But Larry Fitzgerald was an absolute stud. So if that's the downside of Marvin Harrison, sign me up. If Malik Nabers is anywhere close to Justin Jefferson, sign me up. And then on Dunze, the scouting report was this guy is a route running, a better route running version of A.J. Brown. And good Lord, I'm in on that as well. I mean, A.J. Brown was a stud and a force for the Eagles. And if Adunze at 6'3 and 220 can continue to do what he did at Washington, I just think this is a great wide receiver draft. But the funny thing about that, Steve, every year is a great wide receiver draft because college football produces wide receivers, defensive backs at a rate that tells you where the game is headed, with teams running with 3 and 4 starting wide receivers, and it just college football feels like 7-on-7 sometimes, and the factory of wide receivers is never short of its supply. So that's the argument for trying to figure out who the best ones are at the top of the draft, because you know wide receiver goes 20 deep, and you can find a guy in the second round, or even Puka Nacua, who is in like the 6th or 7th round, who can lead the NFL in receptions. You know, so it's again this whole draft thing. It's not an exact science. What you're simply and this is what I say to people: what you're simply trying to do is you're trying to get your batting average up there near the top. And you know, people are like, "Well, there's busts all the time. You guys don't know what you're looking at, or my team doesn't know what he's doing. What about this pick?" And I'm like, if the American League batting champion is hitting 310 and the average batting average is 260 yeah. and the worst hitters are hitting 230, we're not talking about hitting 1,000%. You're talking about being 50 points higher than average. And that's what the best drafting teams are trying to do. They know they'll never hit 400 in a season. That's not how this science works. The other side is, you know, it's tough. It's tough to do. But that's, you know, that's the end game in this sort of process, which is in and of itself a little bit silly, but also wildly entertaining.
Well, that's some great draft stuff. So thank you for that. Definitely wanted to have you on to talk mostly about that. But there's two topics that I wanted to end with.
Sure.
And one is your trip to the Masters 2 weeks ago. Now,
yes, sir.
I read obviously your review of it. It was so detailed and so great, but I kind of want you to, for those that didn't read it and for those who have never visited the Masters, kind of verbally, again, go over exactly what you did and
yeah.
what it was like walking the grounds at the Masters for your first time.
Sure. So I don't know when I established it as the thing on my bucket list I've never done and I want to do someday, but I suppose somewhere in the Tiger run, I always thought, man, I got to get there. And then I found out it was like the most impossible ticket in U.S. sports and had no idea how that would ever happen. I think I got in a couple lotteries over the years and didn't win and just figured at some point I would start to go. I would get there some year. Maybe I would get an invite. And this year it happened. And I guess I stopped thinking about it, but my buddy figured out a way to get us a couple tickets and we could pick our day even, which felt really insane. And so we picked the Tuesday practice round. Now, why did we pick the Tuesday practice round? basically because like five people said that's a great idea. I don't know if it's scientific or not, but if you go on Wednesday, half the day is the par three tournament, and that looks kind of neat, but not really. If you only go there once, do you want to not be on the actual course? Yeah. Because that's the point. So I didn't want to do Wednesday. And then they said the competition rounds are way more buttoned up and way more, way less access. You can't take your camera, for instance. Now, you can never take your phone, but you can take an old camera. And when I say old, it might only be like 10 years old, but it's funny that none of us who have cameras have touched it since we really discovered these things called phones. And the phone has obliterated the camera. So as a quick aside, I know we always joke about Blockbuster losing out in progress, but I hope nobody has stock in like Nikon or camera, you know, Canon cameras, because I can't imagine they're doing real well in 2024, but maybe I don't know what I'm talking about. Anyway, so on Tuesday in the practice round, you can go there, you can take your camera, and I was told all the players are super chill and relaxed and just having a good time. And I swear that's exactly what happened. And so we drove from Atlanta on Tuesday morning, and we wanted to get there nice and early. And it was just a magical day of everything you hoped. This what if people aren't big golf fans, what makes the Masters the Masters and what makes it the number one golf tournament in the sport is quite simply because it's at this place every year. And there's obviously no question about it. Now, the U.S. Open is great. The British Open is great. But they rotate. And so if the U.S. Open was always at Pebble Beach, for instance, we would probably treat that the same way. But they rotate it. And so you only see Pebble Beach once a decade. And, you know, people debate, well, the U.S. Open's, Valhalla this year, or Baltistral, or wherever they take it, or Oak Hill, and you just are like, okay, well, I'm kind of learning a brand new course because I don't know I don't have a 50-year base of knowledge. But Augusta, we're literally talking about the exact same holes for 100 years, or close to 100 years now. I think 1931 or something like that. And so much history, so much of those who love this sport, we can point to the exact spot where Phil hit out of the straw in 13, or Bubba, had to hit a hook on 10, or Tiger rolled it in on 16, or all of these things. I mean, here's where Arnie did this and Jack did that. And it's, I described it, Steve, as going to the Hall of Fame, but you're at a Hall of Fame where the Hall of Famers are still playing. Yeah. And so the first guy we walked out at about 8 a.m. And I'm telling you, I can't recommend it enough. 8 a.m. on a practice round day, the people aren't fully there and it's quiet, but the players are out doing their practice rounds. And the first guy we saw on the first fairway, completely by accident, was Tiger freaking Woods. And Tiger Woods is playing with Fred Couples and Justin Thomas for their morning practice round. Apparently, it was at 8 a.m. Well, we got there about 8:05, and we just are like, are you kidding me? We're at Augusta. We're at the Masters, and here's Tiger Woods. And it was like that all day long, where, you know, we followed Tiger and Freddie for five holes, and then we want to peel off, and we want to go see Amen Corner. And so now it's, 8:45, and we feel like we have Amen Corner completely to ourselves. Like, no players even. It's just, you're back there, and the trees are so tall that it's all shaded and quiet and serene, and you hear some birds, but you feel, and there's dew everywhere, and you just feel like you have this place to yourself. And then, off in the distance, oh, wow, here comes Dustin Johnson and Max Homa, and they're playing 12, and we're like, well, of course we want to watch this. And so now you're watching them play 12 and 13, and again, you're kind of just with them by yourself, and you can't, like, it feels like virtual reality, where you would type in, I want to watch Dustin Johnson play 13, but just us. And it was such a cool thing. And then by the end of the day, we had realized, this is such a name drop, but our friend Will Zalatoris invited me to walk with him for 9 holes, and that was really fun, and got to see the front 9 again. We saw it with Tiger and Freddie, and so we're like, first of all, I didn't know their practice rounds were only 9 holes, but they played 9 holes, and they spent about 10 minutes on each green, and so it takes a while, but they're I guess they'll play the front one day and the back the next day and really get a feel for what the greens will do for each pin position and so forth. And so when it was done, we were like, yeah, we haven't really seen a ton of the back, and the back is where all the history is. They used to never even show the front on TV until, like, I don't know, 20 years ago, but the back is where all the history is, and each hole has a great story and a great amount of history. And so we wander back there, and we're sitting back at Amen Corner, and we're just having a pimento cheese and a sweet tea, only because I would never order that anywhere else, Steve. But I was there, and I'm like, I have to sit there with a pimento cheese and sweet tea and just look at the 11 green, the 12 green, and the 13 tee. And you're just, it's all the same seat. You just move your head slightly. So it's bigger than you think, but also smaller than you think, that those greens are all right next to each other. And then we get done with our sandwich, and I say to my friend Tom, hey, let's go see why there are still people over there. And it looked like it was 15 and 16. We walk over to 15, and there's Rory McIlroy and Ludwig Aubert, the young kid who's all the craze. And we watch them play the final 4 holes, including skipping shots across on the 16th pond. And I'm telling you, it was everything I hoped it would be. It was just such a bucket list check mark where you're like, I had this vision in my head of what this day might be like, and I'll be darned, it exceeded expectations. And we just couldn't get the smile off our face. It was just such a fun thing. I described it as, it's like going to Cooperstown, but there's Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig playing baseball right in front of you. So I realize Tiger Woods isn't dead and Rory is still on the tour and all that, but just the fact that I wasn't watching complete spares play the course was really cool. You know, very meaningful players to me and to everybody were just arm's length away, and you're just walking the course, but they're casual, they're saying hi to people, they're enjoying themselves. And before the tournament, you don't feel like you're missing anything. I think if you went to the tournament and you had no phone and you had no modern technology and no video screens and no anything, I think you would feel like you're actually missing the tournament, even though you're right there. So I'm not sure I would want to be there on a Sunday at the Masters, because I don't think I would have any idea what's happening in the actual tournament, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, the fact that you're there, that you saw it, and this is what I've told my listeners for the longest time, people just don't understand how hilly that course is, probably played a role in Tiger falling apart on the weekend. He just physically can't do it, but it is so much more hilly than it looks on television. And
that's right.
The other thing is obviously the greens. And this is a question that I've always had. Take the average golfer. I don't know, maybe yourself. If I put you on every Masters green 40 feet away, laying one, so you're on the green and one, you don't even have to hit a tee shot. You don't have to fairway shot, no bugger. You are laying one on the green 40 feet away on every green. Do you break par? So that would be basically three putting from 40 feet away on 18 holes would be 72. So could you three putt from 40 feet away on those greens? An average golfer.
I would love to try. I think it would be a real challenge. And you know, I love all of these challenges because I would say I think I could make a run at par, Steve, just to answer your question for once in this interview. I just want to give you a direct answer. But then I want to say I've enjoyed all of the hypotheticals around Masters Week, like the one where, you know, what would like a 7 handicap shoot from the championship tees during, and I really think the Masters, and they would never do this, but I would love to see like a 10 handicap like me, or a 7 handicap or whatever, you know, a guy who plays golf, loves golf, but just make them play in those conditions for us to see what we're talking about, you know, and just to see how hard it is, because those guys make it look easy. And I'm saying some of those are like a 490 or a 510 yard par four, and these little corridors and these galleries and this pressure and just everything. I have a hard time thinking like 110 or so is what people would shoot from there, even though they usually are shooting about 85 at a normal course. So you just can't explain the degree of difficulty of that course. And that's what makes it so much fun to go visit. I'm so happy I did, and I can't wait to go back. I really want to make that happen.
So I wanted to end with this. I will be self-admittedly, I am a late comer to the sport of hockey. I got into it once my nephew started playing. He plays in high school for Prosper. Go to all his games. Love it. Started watching Dallas Stars hockey probably in the last – a lot more in the last 5 or 6 years. I won't watch regular season hockey when Tampa plays, you know, Columbus. But sure. I'll watch the Stars on Bally's when I can, and obviously come playoff time, I am locked in. And I'm so much more nervous during a hockey playoff game than I am for – basically any other sport. And, you know, the Dallas Stars get the number one seed in the Western Conference this year. They drop the puck tonight against, you know, the defending Stanley Cup champions who,
right,
you know, I don't know if they weren't trying to win that Ducks game in the last game of the season that would have given the Stars the Kings in the first round, which obviously you would rather have taken. But you're a big hockey guy and have always been, and I just want you to – not talk me off the ledge of this Stars Golden Knights first round matchup, but explain why this Stars team, outside of obviously things that I've talked, the fact that we have 8 20 goal scorers, which isn't that unheard of in hockey? One other team, or are they the only team that's ever done that? Or very few have ever done that, but
very few.
Kind of break down this team in this series.
Well, I think we have to start at the start, which is hockey, unlike basketball, while they have best-of-seven series, and the whole point of a best-of-seven, first of all, let's not get it twisted, is to fill 2 months of our life with the playoffs, and we love that. But the other reason, hypothetically, for a best-of-seven series is to try to ensure the best team wins. And in the NBA... I feel like we got to be over 90% where the better team survives in 2 weeks. Now there are upsets, but they are rare. They are special, and they are seldom seen. Now there are obviously there are 50-50 series in the NBA. So I'm not talking about those, but I'm talking about an actual like March Madness level upset.
Yeah.
They don't really happen in the NBA.
Nope.
In the NHL, you could play best of three, best of seven, best of 21, and you would still get massive upsets because this is a sport with a very small margin for error. Every sport calls itself a game of inches, but when you have a small puck and the traffic in front of the net and just the way the sport works with speed and chaos, there are upsets all the time, and I mean every year there are massive upsets. Last year, the best example is probably Seattle taking out the Colorado Avalanche, and that makes no sense. There's just no at all sense to try to justify that the defending Cup champions of last year could be eliminated by a team without really any star player at all. And you know, kind of a de facto expansion team.
And wasn't Colorado up 3-1 in that series as well?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And so it's hockey.
Yeah.
It's hockey. And so every year we see this going back to the San Jose Sharks taking out the Detroit Red Wings when the Red Wings were on the fringe of being a dynasty. And you know, this is a sport where the best team doesn't always win. And so I want to say all that as a preface to, I do believe the Dallas Stars are the best team in the West.
Yeah.
I really do. But I also know this dang sport comes down to a few crazy things. One will be, a call that will be made that will put a team on the power play that may not deserve it, and it could decide the whole darn series. One will depend on your goaltender making one more save than the other guy. And so, yes, The Stars are loaded. They are built for all sorts of types of games, and they, you know, the kids and the trade for Tanev and all the things they've done have put themselves in a position where I think it's reasonable to say the Stars can win the Stanley Cup this year. At the same time, they could be eliminated within 10 days. Yeah. And that's just hockey. And so if I'm the Stars, and I'll be in the building tonight when they play Las Vegas in game one, if I'm the Stars, I cannot afford to give Las Vegas one of these first two games at our place. And you've got to jump on them early, and you've got to show them that a year difference has meant a lot to both organizations. Vegas has gone backwards, but they've also been very squirrely in acquiring talent, working around the cap. And now they are mysteriously all healthy here for game one. Now that the cap doesn't apply in the postseason, they can field their team and hopefully prove to the world that they're not really an eight seed, but they were a sleeping giant that now is ready to, you know, go get a second cup. The Stars have to jump on them tonight. I think I hate to call game one a must win game because that sounds like, you know, media hyperbole, but I do think if the Stars show some vulnerability, you know, we could see a little deja vu from last year when Vegas was clearly a better hockey team. The Stars were vulnerable last year because of two things, in my opinion. One, they were super top heavy and they needed Robertson, Hintz, and Pavelski to do all of their scoring. Yeah. And two, they were extremely special teams dependent. And so their power play could kill everybody. The problem is in the playoffs, there are almost no power plays because the refs swallow their whistles and make you win 5-on-5, which we love. We love that the refs are letting the players fight for the game. But we also hate, you know, the fact that there will be no power plays no matter what the other team does, because the refs don't want to put anybody on the advantage. So it's a big circle. But the point is the Stars were so power play dependent that when they stopped calling power plays, the Stars were screwed. And then they sort of petered out of energy in, you know, by their third round. And frankly, they did not play a heavyweight contender until the third round. They got very lucky with Minnesota and Seattle in the first two rounds, and it might have been a little fool's gold. This year, they have built to fix all of those leaks. They have way more depth, as you pointed out, absurd depth, three lines deep. They are not power play dependent. They are not top heavy. They have better defense, and they think they have built for a four-round journey against some very difficult competition. It could be Vegas in round one, Colorado in round two, although they lost game one in Winnipeg. But I think they can do it. But again, it's hockey. And so in hockey, we better be ready for a lot of stressful nights and the fact that this could go wrong in a hurry as well.
And if I'm not mistaken, we were talking about last year with Colorado being upset by Seattle up 3-1 with two of their final three games in that series at home, and they lose.
Yes.
Didn't Boston lead the league in points last year and go out in the first
yes.
round? Was that last year?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, I believe Boston last year might have set a record for points in a season.
That's right.
And Florida took them out. So, yeah. You know, seldom in this sport. Like, I mean, come on, the NBA, we said, oh, it's LeBron versus Golden State in the finals. And it was for like four years in a row. Goofy like that. Well, in this sport, if you get one versus one in the Stanley Cup Finals, that's a rarity. There are always upsets. There are always teams that go on runs with a goalie that you just can't beat. And it's the best team doesn't always win in the sport. I bet you if the NBA is over 90%, I bet you in hockey it's I don't know, maybe 67% or 65%. You know, two out of every three, the best team wins, and then that third one is called hockey. And so that's just how the sport rolls. And some people say it's what makes it intoxicating, and some people say it's what makes it endlessly frustrating.
Yeah. Well, we'll all be watching tonight for game one. So, Bob, thanks Again, for coming on, you can get him at bobsturm.substack.com if you want to listen to his NFL draft coverage. Be on the Ticket Sports Day app. Bob, thanks again for coming on. And we'll obviously be in touch when Adam Schefter tweets something stupid.
I can't wait. That's one of your best power moves. I love it.
All right, Bob. Thanks again. Appreciate it.
See you, brother.
Yeah. Telling you, man, he's an encyclopedia. I mean, that draft talk for the first 30 minutes was you're not going to find a lot better there. And like he explained, he almost felt like a fraud for all those years from probably 95 to 2005 covering the NFL draft. And then he's like, look, I'm going to dive headfirst into this. I'm going to look at tape. If you sign up for bobsturm.substack.com, you will see him doing profiles on 60 players that are probably in the Cowboys range in the first three rounds. And we're talking detailed breakdown with video footage of all these players, what you're supposed to be looking at when you're looking at video footage. I mean, it's just, this is exactly what you want if you're an absolute draft nerd, and Bob's one of the best at it. So check that out if you can. Bobsturm.substack.com. I think it's $85 for a year, and you get every article that he releases. He's great during football season, but he's also got great stuff on hockey, as you heard there at the end. Dallas Mavericks stuff, Texas Rangers stuff, his Masters review from his trip there. You could just tell, I mean, how much he loved it. And basically what he said on this podcast is what he wrote. It's just like, it's almost hard to explain as much as he tried. It's still just quite the experience to go there. So again, thanks so much to Bob for coming on, and maybe we'll have him on beginning of the NFL season. So for Bob Sturm, I'm Reality Steve. Thank you all for tuning in. I really appreciate it. Tell your friends. The Daily Roundup was posted about an hour ago. And we'll be back tomorrow, obviously, with another Sports Daily. So for Bob Sturm, I'm Reality Steve. Again, I appreciate you all listening. And remember, sports will always be the greatest reality show on television.